I'd like to talk with you about, to begin with, the 8 qualities of a great person. This is a written record that survived after several hundred years of oral transmission, literally, in the canon of teachings, suttas from early Buddhism. And the sutta itself is really interesting. Now, there's some stuff about it that you kind of go with, like the Buddha has these psychic abilities that teleport himself after telepathically understanding what someone was thinking about. And then he teleports himself back and, you know, all that sort of stuff. So there's some fireworks here. And the language is traditional and it's gendered. It's in the context of society in northern India, 2,500 or so years ago. All that said, I want to highlight some key points here and then use the 8th of these qualities as a way into exploring just how good it feels to come to rest and how to do that, following the advice and a progression from our root teacher, the Buddha. All right? So I'm going to kind of highlight some things about this sutta. You could take some time with it later. I'm going to sort of skim through it and bounce around a little bit. And this has been translated by, definitely probably one of my favorite translators of all, the wonderful monk Bhikkhu Bodhi, whose work with, by the way, Buddhist Global Peace, something like that, close to that, is a wonderful nonprofit charity that supports people around the world. Okay, so I'm going to summarize. On one occasion, the Blessed One, the Buddha, was dwelling among the Bhagas, I'm going to mangle a lot of this, in Sahamsagariya in the deer park of Besakala Grove. Meanwhile, on that occasion, the Venerable Anuruddha, this is somebody else, dwelled among the Setis in the eastern bamboo park. Okay? And while the Venerable Anuruddha was alone in seclusion, in meditation, a course of thought arose in his mind thus. This Dhamma, this teaching, is for one with few desires, not for one with strong desires. This teaching, this way, is for one who is content, not for one who is discontent. Now, to be clear, before we go further, we often start with strong desires and discontentment. That's okay. He's really speaking to what are the qualities that are developed in practice. That's how to understand this here. And these 8 qualities that are developed in practice are both a stretch and they're down to earth. They're not mystical. They're not magical. They're attainable. Okay? So then third, this Dhamma is for one who resorts to solitude, not for one who delights in company, someone who's comfortable being alone. This is for someone who is energetic, not for someone who is lazy. This is for someone with mindfulness. This is for someone who is concentrated. And this is for someone who is wise. So just kind of pause here. A way to understand this is, okay, we have a bit of a checklist here. We have descriptions, aspirational descriptions. I like watching people who are good at things. You know, recently tennis, the World Cup, rock climbing, chess, other strange things, surfing. People are really good at it, you know? So here Anuruddha is reflecting what is being developed here in one who is deepening in practice. These are qualities, 7 are listed so far, of letting go of unnecessary desires. You can certainly keep desires for a better world. This is developed as we develop contentment, being content. We're comfortable, you know, going deep in our own practice and relying on ourselves. We're also bringing some energy to this. We're not slacking around. Joseph Goldstein once described this as relaxed but not lazy, something like that. Relaxed but not casual. And then let's see, we have mindfulness. We're developing in our mindfulness. Okay. And we're deepening in training in the mind and concentration. and cultivating insight and wisdom along the way. Very good. Then the Buddha reads the mind of Anuruddha, goes, and then teleports himself into conversation with Anuruddha. And the Buddha says, good, Anuruddha. It is good that you have reflected on these seven qualities of a great person. Goes through the list. And also, you should reflect on the eighth quality, the eighth thought of a great person, being someone who delights in non-proliferation, who takes delight in non-proliferation. What is the Buddha talking about there? So just tapping the brakes briefly, you might like to reflect on yourself. How are you doing with wanting little? For me, I'm working on just letting go of the normal machinery of scanning for something new to want. You know, dopamine nation. And that hunger for something new to want is fed by modern society. So it's kind of autonomous and rebellious to say, time out with that. Nope. You're not going to keep hooking me with wanting something new. I'm letting go of some of that. Also being more content, you know, just okay, appreciating enoughness. There's a Taoist line, someone who knows when enough is enough always has enough. Also, we appreciate, you know, being secluded, going inward, you know, being with ourselves. We appreciate company. You know, Sangha is one of the three jewels of good company, you know, other people. Sure, there's a time and a place, but also we're comfortable in our own inner practice. Fourth, we, you know, bring some energy to the practice. Five, we've got mindfulness going. Six, there's some training of the mind, deepening concentration, reducing distraction. And we're gathering insight and wisdom along the way. And, we're delighting in non-proliferation. Now, the word for proliferation in Pali, language of early Buddhism, is papancha. And it's interesting that the Buddha is speaking to someone, Anuruddha, who's very developed, and saying, Anuruddha, don't forget about non-proliferation. Don't forget about delighting in not proliferating in your mind. What is this proliferation? Proliferation, you can watch it. It's just the discursive, self-referential, wandering, seeking habits of the mind. It's what happens when we're in the default mode network in the back and mind wandering and ruminating. It's also when we're just chasing one, you know, problem after another or trying to accomplish one thing after another. There is a place for directed thought. There is a place for it. But I don't know about you. I sure wish my mind were quieter. You know, in a sense, what the Buddha is talking about here is delighting in, taking pleasure in, valuing a quieter mind, a quieter mind. If you think about it, the first seven qualities that are listed in the qualities of a great person, which we can become and we are on the path of becoming, they have to do with character. They have to do with kind of your who you are, what kind of a person you are. The eighth one is about liberation, in effect. It's liberating from the endless chasing of the next shiny object in the theater of consciousness. Whew. What a relief. The word for that chasing, papancha, is fun to say, papancha. You know, it has that feeling. I visualize one of these sort of time-lapse movies of a rainforest, like in the jungles in the Amazon, in which the vines and tendrils and plants and leaves are growing kind of at warp speed. You know, that's our mind. You know, in just a second or two, you know, you can have like five different thoughts pass through awareness, like, you know, bubbling away. Oh, it's a lot. It's kind of wearying, right? It's exhausting to have so much cooking, so much going on. We're not trying to suppress anything here. The Buddha's not saying, you know, shut it down or, you know, be angry at yourself about it. He's saying delighting in its absence. Whoa, how do we do that? There's more in the sutta about how this delight in non-proliferation, you know, is engaged in practice. I'll kind of skip over that. It really doesn't matter. I'm not going to bother with that, but I'm going to keep going. So then a reasonable question, especially if you're neurologically inclined, is to ask, whoa, what is non-proliferation neurologically? Does that mean just shutting down experiences, the flow of experiences? How can there be the, quote, stilling of the proliferating self-referential elaboration of experience? That's what we're talking about here. How can there be in your brain and mine the stilling of the proliferating self-referential elaboration of experience? How does this work? Well, in the Buddha Dharma, it's understood that there are three roots or factors of this proliferation, papancha. One is craving. The more we're caught up in craving, the more noise there is in the mind. Okay. Second root is comparing, especially comparing that's very self-referential. You know, am I up? Am I down? What do you think about me? Do you have more? Do I have less? Comparing. Is this better? Is that worse? Right? Comparing mind. There's some kind of proverb that comparison is the thief of joy. Comparing is the second root of this mental proliferation. So you can see that as we reduce craving and reduce comparing, and I'll get to the third root in a second, we reduce proliferation, papancha, noise. The third root of papancha in the Buddha Dharma is views, is getting caught up in our thoughts about their thoughts, about our thoughts, about who's right, who's wrong, what's correct, what's the right way to look at something, you know, what's their opinion, what's my opinion. Hoy, one of my, I don't know if it's a guilty pleasure, there's some guilt probably. One of my, you know, pleasures is I'll spend about, I admit it, about 10 to 15 minutes, probably no more, a day in political social media. I have several people I track. They're good curators of the latest. It's a good way to kind of track commentary. And wow, you can just see whether it's Blue Sky, my favorite, or Twitter, or in other areas like Facebook commentaries on commentaries on commentaries, or in the new, you know, like on TV, talking heads. Wow, it's just a bunch of talk about their talk, about my talk, about their talk, about my talk. That's exhausting. So views, all right? So there is bare experience. There is, as you probably got to in the meditation, you know, a quiet. There's an ongoingness of experiencing, right? There are sensations, you know, there is a kind of a basic sense of what's happening. There is a minimal sense of liking or disliking or being neutral in its simple form. You know, basic thoughts are arising. People are functioning, you know, it's time for dinner, opening the refrigerator. It's basic, but there's not a lot added to it. The question is, how do we add less to the resting state of ongoing experiencing? Now, I'll give you an extreme example. And I say this as someone who went to the dentist yesterday. In this example, which I read in a magazine some years ago, a monk living in Southeast Asia in very simple conditions, without much medical care, certainly without dental care, is developing a really serious toothache. So the monk tells the story, and if you're alarmed about dentistry, you might want to turn off my sound or something or other, or just kind of keep some distance here. Basically, the monk tells the story that, you know, there was great pain and there was walking toward the tool shed where there was knowing that there was a pair of pliers. And there was stepping and stepping and stepping and simply stepping and opening the door of the shed and then reaching and then holding the pliers and then placing the pliers and then pulling suddenly and some pain and then less pain and then setting down the pliers and observing what they were holding and then turning and walking back out through the door, stepping, stepping, stepping back to the little hut of meditation. Whoa, that's a pretty good example of not adding a lot to it, right? Okay, the problem is not the ongoingness of basic functioning and experiencing, including, you know, some necessary planning, plans to send an email or run a meeting or prepare a talk. It's what we add to it. It's this constructing, this fabricating is a key word, this adding to the basics of this second layer, which very often includes, as you know the metaphor, the second arrows or second darts of our own suffering that gets laid on top of basic sensory pain or the basic loss of certain pleasures, all right? How might that happen in the brain? Well, there's some good research about this. There's some growing research that, for example, Judson Brewer, among others, Shinzen Yang, among others, Richie Davidson, University of Wisconsin, among others, are showing that people who have greater training in meditation, like you're getting here yourself, and like maybe you're encouraging those in your networks to check out, people with a growing meditative practice, in formal practice, when they're doing it with an MRI, and by extension, probably increasingly as a trait, in everyday life, are more and more able to simply be with what's happening as it is without getting a lot of activation in the default mode network, which is in the midline and spreading to the sides in the rearward areas of the brain. In other words, there seem to be very clear and plausible neural correlates of less activity in regions that drive papancha, not the only areas, but major kind of headquarters, you know, for papancha, et cetera, in the brain. As that gets quieter, people report less and less of this proliferative activity. Wow, that's pretty nice, isn't it? You know, so that kind of makes sense here. So just a quick recap. In effect, to borrow from T.S. Eliot, in his poem, Ash Wednesday, he says, teach us to care and not to care. Teach us to sit still. So we care. We care about injustice. We open our hearts to caring and meditation, including we care about our own self-interest and, like, you know, pulling out a diseased tooth, given that that's our option. You know, there's a place for caring. Okay. Reasonable enough. And there's a place for learning to increasingly just not care about the rest, disengage from it. That metaphor I used early on of just coming home from a big trip and plopping in your chair. Ah, that kind of not caring. So how do we actually do this? How do we still the roots of papancha? How do we crave less, compare less, and think less? How do we actually do it? Especially in a culture and a society that is feeding those roots of mental proliferation. Yeah. How do we actually do it? Well, here is where I want to draw your attention to a classic sequence that I've talked about a few weeks ago in Instructions for Meditation. And you can follow this sequence in kind of everyday life. One thing I love about Buddhism and early Buddhism is that apart from the telepathy and teleportation and past lives aspects, you know, maybe a few other bells and whistles, it's very grounded. It's very psychological. It's very common sense. You know, I think about the, you know, the three kind of encouragements in a kindergarten, you know, pay attention and share your toys. Pretty basic, right? There's a lot about Buddhism that has a kind of basicness to it. So here we have this sequence. Number one is personal virtue, not some kind of necessary saintliness. This is the first of the three basic pillars of Buddhist practice, sila, sometimes translated as virtue or morality or non-harming, including yourself, restraint, ethics, you know, getting your stuff together, walking lightly as you move through the world, not landing hard on other people, not giving people cause to feel mistreated by you, reasonable cause. And that's virtue. Virtue then leads to the bliss of blamelessness. And again, you don't have to be perfect. I'm really talking about, going back to my talk previous week, of grounding yourself in what you bow to, you know, grounding yourself into what you both accept and also what you appreciate. And on the basis of that, establishing yourself in your principles, your commitments, your inclinations, your promises, your word, through what you vow. And then at the end of the day, you look back and you go, hey, I wasn't a schmo. I came from my heart today, right? I made efforts and, you know, I learned a little along the way. Good enough. Good on you. Huh. That's the non-remorse. That's the non-remorse part where, you know, you're not caught up in guilt or shame. There's no basis for it, essentially, at least today, right? Lovely. The bliss of blamelessness, which then leads onward to, and I'm going back to the sequence, gladness. Gladness is a very interesting experience. The Buddha is calling out states of being that are differentiated from other states of being, not to be pedantic or complicated per se, not to be pedantic at all, nor complicated per se, but rather to become more mindful, to deepen our granularity of mindfulness. Because as we become skillful with anything, you know, I talked about earlier, skillfulness with tennis or golf or cooking. I love watching these cooking shows. Or, you know, rap. Eminem is amazing. A lot of other great rappers too. Just skillfulness in any domain. You know, it involves a differentiated clarity, a granularity of mindfulness around various distinctions. And then they become integrated later. We differentiate, then we integrate. It's a long time saying. And so that's what the Buddha is pointing us to. So gladness, the gladness that arises from a clean conscience or a relatively clean conscience, you know, that's a really beautiful thing. Has qualities, I've said earlier, of relief and reassurance in it. Like, yeah, I'm all right. Yeah. Gladness, really nice, right? And then what can gladness lead onward to? Gladness can lead onward to what's the word is piti in Pali, language of early Buddhism, a key language of early Buddhism. And piti can be translated as rapture or bliss or joy. And there can be pulses of piti, or as practice deepens, you can just become awash in it. Like so, I've been there. Maybe some, I assume many of you have as well, in your own practices, you're just so absorbed in rapture and kind of being in love with the present moment. It can be a little hard to get up out of your chair, you know. Ugh. And piti, like two of the other steps in this path I'll get to in a moment, are among the seven factors of awakening. It's kind of wild that a tradition that's very prepared to be renunciate and has a jaundiced view of, you know, clinging and craving really values intensely enjoyable, emotionally positive experiences as factors of liberation. Whoa, pretty cool. So you can see this following, and you can, in your own efforts, you can help virtue, your everyday virtue, become freedom from remorse, you know, a sense of gladness in your goodness. And as that recognition of your goodness deepens, you can kind of encourage it, kind of open to or invite gladness. And then as you rest in gladness, including in meditation, you can invite and open into, if it will come, it may not, but you can open to it, you can invite it. May piti arise. A traditional instruction in meditation that moves into deepening absorption involves may such and such arise. You know, may mindfulness arise. May steadiness of mind arise. May gladness arise. May rapture and joyfulness arise. And then piti, which is pretty darn intense, you know, it's just hard to sustain. It just naturally settles down, and it settles down into tranquility. Now, by the way, in terms of the sequence, sometimes it really happens is that you skip a step. And it's not uncommon, I think, to just go fairly directly to tranquility. You know, the body relaxes, the breathing slows, especially with, you know, sustained practice of meditation, and increasingly a mind that's, you know, has often privilege, not always privilege, but sometimes privilege of less and less to worry about. But for whatever reason, it gets more and more settled, more and more resolved, kind of settled more rapidly into tranquility, one of the seven factors of awakening, in which the root of the word for tranquility in Pali, the roots have to do with an intensification of settling. So there's a common metaphor, a very lovely one, of a pond whose contents gradually settle. The sediments subside, and the always pure water of being becomes apparent, including the jewels that have always been there at the bottom in the heart of your own being. Tranquility. Stillness. Nice. And then tranquility, again, with a little encouragement sometimes or invitation, because that peacefulness, that tranquility can feel fairly kind of inert, you know, like, okay, tranquil. It then opens further into, in Pali, sukha. Sukha is the root of the word for sucrose or sugar. In Sanskrit or then in English later, it's sweet. There's a contentment. Tranquility becomes contentment. You know, tranquility is not very affectively valenced because you're really, really tranquil. It's a real stillness. Sukha is affectively positive. It's enjoyable. It's contentment. It's like, oh, I am content. You know, it's a sense of well-being with no wish for anything else. There's a release from the urgency, the proliferating energy of becoming. There's no juice for becoming because you're good right now. Now, around this contentment, or included in it, literally could be physical pain, could be anguish in the back of your mind, could be grieving, you're still grieving. Years later, you're still grieving. The loss of this or that, you know, it's there. And still, in the present somehow, there's a sense of enoughness in this progression, right? In this progression. And then sukha leads onward in the classic progression to samadhi. Samadhi is a non-ordinary, samadhi can be understood in an ordinary sense. It's just growing steadiness of mind, deepening concentration. In two senses of the word concentration, you are becoming more and more stably with your object of attention, which could be sensations of breathing. Your object of attention could be loving kindness. Your object of attention also could be gladness, leading onward to joyfulness, leading onward to tranquility. These can be objects of attention to help you become more and more absorbed in them, and leading onward, et cetera, into contentment and then deep samadhi. that sense of concentration, you know, instead, you know, like you're in it. And also like concentrating a sauce, you become more and more pervaded by tranquility. You know, it is concentrated as an experience within you. Right? So there's an ordinary sense of the word samadhi, and samadhi is a pointing toward the right concentration or wise concentration, eighth element of the Eightfold Path, in which you're moving into non-ordinary states of being called the jhanas that are well known. You know, I've experienced certainly the first two fairly stably, and I've known many people have moved through the four basic ones and then onward, da 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 da. But you know, you're not in Kansas anymore. And everything up to that point is completely within reach in everyday contemplative practice, and even within reach in everyday life, and really worth exploring, not out of any kind of pressure, but out of honoring the Buddha's invitation, and frankly, out of cultivating states and traits in your own consciousness. Neurologically, there are multiple ways to help experiences or states of gladness or tranquility or joyfulness or contentment and so forth become traits, become increasingly rested in you, to move from state gladness to trait gladness, from state tranquility to trait tranquility, right? If only in the background of consciousness. And a key way to do this, to you can help yourself, help these experiences leave lasting traces in your body, in your nervous system, in literally lasting changes of structure and function in your brain. Multiple ways to do it. I wrote a paper about this, published paper called Learning to Learn from Positive Experiences. Multiple factors I've taught. There are three that are kind of major go-tos I return to again and again. Anyone is good, more is better. Number one, duration. Stay with the experience. That's why steadiness of mind is a factor of neuroplastic change, because then you can stay with the experience. You keep the neurons firing so they start wiring together. Second, feel it in your body. The more embodied your tranquility, your gladness, your contentment, the more it will lodge within you. And enjoy it. Stay with what's enjoyable about it. Focus on what's enjoyable. Really enjoy it. Because actually, as you really enjoy it, the basis for craving and clinging falls away, because increasingly, it's just inside you already. You don't have to go outside yourself looking for peace of mind, tranquility, or a sense of gladness in your own goodness, not arrogantly, but with reassurance and relief. You don't have to look outside yourself for that, because you've stayed with the experience, you've felt it in your body, and you've enjoyed it hundreds, if not thousands of times, a few breaths or less at a time. To what extent are the qualities we've been naming here, they're all psychological, ordinary, they're in the dictionary, qualities of mind, qualities of being, to what extent are they already present in your daily life? Okay, cool. To what extent are, you know, virtue, non-remorse, gladness, rapture, joyfulness, tranquility, and contentment present in your life? And, you know, what opportunities might there be for you in increasing them? I go back to the first two qualities or characteristics of a quote-unquote great person, of making your wants less. You know, I've just started to watch it. I've just started the ways in which my mind is like, and I'm fairly kind of mellow, partly due to privilege, partly due to training and temperament. But whoa, it's just goal seeking, the generation of goals. Then I look at them and go, huh. And there's a way in which you start to realize that your brain, you know, especially its reward seeking systems that are, you know, evolved with the earliest mammals, they're really kind of primitive. It's like an inner ad agency that's constantly pitching you something new to want. And increasingly, it's like, no, I can renounce that. I can let go of that. Wise intention is one of the elements of the Eightfold Path. It's the second one typically listed, right intent. And one of the three aspects of right intention is renunciation, not out of pushing away, but out of freedom from wanting. It's great. And, you know, wanting has these two meanings, including a sense of want or lack. So that moves us into the second of the eight qualities of a great person, being content, you know, really training and appreciating this subtle but very important feeling of being content rather than discontent and tracking that difference. All right. So kind of bringing it home here, you can, you know, I think I've named maybe eight key things to pay attention to, sort of, whatever, such as tranquility or gladness or, you know, contentment. But really it boils down to where we started. Teach us to care or not to care. This whole teaching about delighting in non-proliferation is delighting in wise not caring. Not caring enough to chase it. Not caring enough to feed or follow it. Not being interested in the next shiny object. You know, your brain just throws up for you to want. Tosses it up on the screen. Look at me, chase me, want me. Yeah, get into it. You're like, yeah, I'm good. I'm good already. Enoughness already. I'm okay already. That's what this is about. Not caring about that. And on the other hand, teach us to care about virtue. Teach us to care about freedom from remorse. Teach us to care about gladness. We cultivate and what we appreciate. You know, the old line, what you appreciate, appreciates. All right? Teach us to care about joyfulness, tranquility, and contentment. And teach us to care along the way without getting caught up in goal seeking. Teach us to care about transformative, revelatory, non-ordinary states of consciousness that are available to us all progressively with practice. Right? And again, teach us not to care about the habitual chasings and graspings of the mind. You know, not to care about comparisons and who is up and who is down, and not to care about, you know, so much about being right or caught up in views. What a beautiful path. So let's sit for a minute. Just kind of marinate in this. Let's care enough to sit in wisdom about what not to care about. You're letting all this reverberate within you. Whatever is good, you're letting it linger. So it gradually leaves lasting traces in your body, in your brain, with benefits for yourself and many other beings. Okay, thank you for going along with this ride. I hope it was useful for you. I think it's really helpful to finish here. When one faces, you know, original teachings from the Buddha, it's the big leagues. It's a master class. And it can sometimes seem a little daunting. Whoa, all these words and states of mind, and oh man, where do I start? Wow. And it's really helpful, number one, to trust in your own nature, deep down, through and through. Just to like, okay, that which is noble within me, that which is good within me is drawn to this, and I can be lived increasingly by what is always already good within me. And you can have some humor and playfulness about the journey. We're learning, and learning involves correcting, you know, riding a bicycle. You lean left, then you got to lean right, and you're like constantly doing that. Think about sailing, zigging and zagging, but toward your goal. It's okay. It's playful. It's all right. And appreciate your own efforts along the way. It's really important. And keep it simple. You know, pick one thing. These days, I'm really zeroed in a lot on, you know, Thoreau's line, I think. I make myself rich by making my wants few. Right? That doesn't justify poverty and oppression, whatever. Just, I mean, you know, disengaging from the ad agencies out there in the world and inside your own mind. You might have a different thing. You might be very interested in the gladness in your own goodness, non-remorse. Maybe tranquility is calling to you. Oh, great. Maybe you're interested in becoming more mindful of your tendency toward comparing. This moment compared to previous moments, yourself compared to others, that person compared to that person. Maybe that's your practice. You know, it's good. Pick one thing. Kind of, you know, keep that as a major focus for a while. And keep meditating. And keep coming back. Take good care. Thank you. It's a wrap.